Hello, World Weavers, and welcome back to the Atlas Loom, an exploration of world building for tabletop and beyond. My name is Endeavorance. I am one of your hosts. I am joined, as always, by Diana, a woman who recently won the World Yo-Yo Championship. I want to know what your strategy was going into that.
I actually just went through beforehand, snuck backstage, tied everyone else's yo-yos into knots, and then left a threatening note saying something along the lines of around the way, like it was like an around the world pun. No, that was a bad start. I swear to God, I had a thought for where that would go. That would actually be a pun. And then halfway through, my brain was like, you don't know puns. Let's quit this.
What's a pun?
Thank you. I'm here. I'm not actually. Dude, I remember being a kid and like going to toy stores and buying a yo-yo that was like $2 or $3 and having that be just like the focus of my existence for the week after that. And I saw so many videos of people doing like cool tricks, like walking the dog and all those other ones that I don't know the names of. And I was like, I'm going to learn how to do all of this. And I could barely get it to go up.
Oh, yeah. I feel like yo-yos and slinkies became your entire personality the moment that you had one. And then like object permanence, not fully developed. It's in a different room after a couple of days, doesn't exist anymore. So like, whatever. But I never got to the point where I got a couple of those like advanced boy yo-yos, that ones that could like that you could like hold, like they would go down and spin or whatever. And then you could like pull them back up. I had a couple of those that I was able to do that, like a walk the dog situation. But like that's about as far as I ever got in my personal professional yo-yo career.
Right. Your yo-yo career, which is your side gig up to this day.
Yeah. They called me Yo-Yo Ma.
Do you remember? OK, kind of a tangent. Do you remember thinking putty? Like those different kinds of like kind of silly putty, but it had like gimmicks, right? There was like the magnetic one and the glow in the dark one. And then the ones that were like kind of shiny, like oil slick style and things like that.
Yo, damn. I didn't know we had advanced silly putty these days.
Yeah,
technology.
They got evolved silly putty now. And damn. I was like, oh, God, toy stores, man. Toys were so much more simple back then. And oh. I mean that with absolute sincerity, like the type of toys kids have nowadays that have like. Oh,
all these bells and whistles, old man Diana out here being like kids these days with their cellular telephones and their internet pads.
Yeah. Mm. Back in my day, we just sat down with pens and paper and dice and, you know, just imagined what happened to those days.
Imagine that. We should do a podcast about that.
We should.
What in this podcast that we're currently doing about that do you want to talk about today, Diana?
That was such a smooth transition.
I did great.
Congratulations. So today we're going to be talking about essentially the fauna that inhabit your world, the monsters, the beasts. We've talked about BBEGs in a past episode, you know, things that you would confront at the culmination of your story. This time we're kind of getting into like the little things that you'd encounter in between, specifically anything non-human. And so I'm obviously really fucking excited for this episode because this is my entire degree.
If you're not aware, I know that this is your degree, but I feel like that, like, I'm not going to get to talk as much this episode. So let me have this one for everyone. Diana has a degree in Zootopia, and that's a thing that she went to college for. And then after she got her degree in it, she got banned from every zoo nationwide. And so she's just really excited to finally be able to use that degree.
Yeah, I am a zoology major. That was my trade basically for the entirety of my childhood and college career. And this is the first time I've actually been able to use it in a professional setting. So here we are.
But animals, though, they're out there in space. they are in your world. And how do you actually populate your world with animals that, one, make sense, two, actually add something, and three, don't overwhelm you as the designer and like doesn't add too much extra work. But at the same time, setting the fauna of your world or of a given area, more specifically of a given area, is a form of set dressing that is very often overlooked and adds just that much more realism to your world. It also opens up a whole new slew of questions that you can then use as prompts to flesh out specifics in your world. It's almost like populating your world with creatures that need to have systems to survive, help you create those systems. And as simple as that may seem, it it really is just something that if we're all a little too focused on the plot and the big bad, sometimes you forget that there should be some deer too.
Oh, yeah. It's like those little details. I distinctly remember an early episode of Critical Role where, and this is just like one of those small potential role play moments, right? That kind of need animals to exist. But like there was someone who was on watch at the end of a day and just them alone did a perception check. And instead of doing like an encounter or like, you know, a bunch of bandits sneaking up on the party, the person saw an owlbear just kind of like off doing its own thing, just hanging out. They just got to observe nature for a moment. And those are the types of real life moments that would be special to us in person. So it's kind of good to give your players the opportunity to do that sort of interaction with nature in game as well. Especially if you have someone who's very nature focused, you know, in D&D terms, if you had like a druid in your party or a paladin, Oath of the Ancients, something like that. Anyone who even has it written into their backstory that they used to work in a menagerie or they're a archaeologist or explorer or like that's their whole shit. Giving them something to work with is a really good idea. And it's a lot easier than you think, especially if you think on it about it along a timeline, kind of like what you were getting at, Dev, earlier, where the creatures that exist in the world will bring up more questions about why are they there? What are they doing there? How do people in the world interact with them? That sort of natural evolution of thinking and that like continually asking yourself why has been the core of our podcast for several episodes now. I think it will continue to be. So trust me when I say that coming up with animals and beasts to fill your world is a lot easier than you think.
I want to get this out of the way early because this just popped into my head. This is not my notes. This is just as you were talking, this popped right into my head. I am just now realizing an excellent example of thinking about the fauna of a given world and the impacts it has and just how far reaching those impacts can be. If you've been at all near any of my content, you've maybe seen me or heard me playing or talking about Palia, which is a MMO cozy game that, long story short, it just takes place in like this cute little valley. But canonically, there is a creature that inhabits this valley called a Choppa. And Choppas, they're like little raccoonish looking creatures. They're adorable. They're super cute. But they're established immediately as invasive, and they are established as having been introduced to this place by the like bumbling mayor of the town that the game takes place in, and he thinks that it's great. They're so cute and everybody loves them, right? But like other people who have different outlooks on like animals and what's going on in this world are like, these fucking things are so obnoxious, they like destroy my crops, they, you know, have disrupted the local ecosystem, or there's a guy who's a hunter who just sees them as nothing but a pest. But the mayor is like, everybody loves the Choppa. And like just recently in the game, there was like, oh, it's the 20th anniversary of having introduced them to the valley. Isn't that lovely? Everybody loves them.
Dude, invasive species is a really good call. I want to get back to that. But it reminds me, wasn't there like some fucking Shakespeare play a long time ago that was like brought over into some other country? And as promotion for the play or as like kind of set dressing, they released a bunch of starlings into a certain ecosystem, and ever since then they've been like invasive or a problem or like non-native because of that one fucking play in biology. And something that you were kind of getting at when it comes to invasive species, there's things called niches or niches. I've heard it both ways. I don't know which is right. They didn't teach me that in those 4 years. But basically, a niche is like the role that your creature plays in an ecosystem. Sometimes that role is invasive, right? So that's a very good example of something that doesn't necessarily need to be filled. It's like optional, but you can have invasive species. So if you have, for instance, maybe you're thinking about the terms of the Feywild, for example. Again, I'm going to refer back to D&D because that is all I know. If you have the Feywild, you have all these native Fey creatures. Something that might stick out for your players is something that is very distinctly not native to the Feywild. Maybe it's something from the Shadowfell as opposed to, you know, this sort of like flowy, fey, elven, ethereal type creature, very connected to the land and very whimsical with all these bright colors. Standing out from that backdrop is going to be this dark, shadowy creature that hunts down those whimsical little fey creatures, right? So having something that is invasive, quote unquote, stands out to your players, stands out in the environment, and also immediately provides a really good plot hook, you know, where you have this thing where maybe natives to the region are like, hey, we want to get rid of this thing, but it's really fucking powerful because it's not supposed to be here. And so nothing around this area ever adapted to it being here. Mm-hmm. So we need to hire someone to come in and get it. So an invasive species is a really good example of one of those niches that you can fill. You can also fill the role of predator. Very easy to do, very self-explanatory. And then opposite that, you have prey. Thinking about like kind of the food pyramid. What's the herbivore in your world? What's the first like trophic level above that? What feeds on the herbivores? What feeds on the things that feeds on those herbivores? Depending on how detailed you want to get. You can also think about symbiotic species to each of those species. So for example, if you have, you can kind of think of it in the same vein as those sharks that have those little like
little sucky
fish.
Boys. Yeah.
The smaller fish that kind of follow along with sharks and feed on whatever scraps they leave behind. You can take that concept and apply it to whatever fantasy creature you have. So if you have a predator in your campaign and your world, every once in a while, you might want to think about sprinkling in a prey creature that is following that creature along in a very, like, basically use the shark small fish template and apply it to like a land creature or a flying creature. You know, maybe you have a giant bird that has a bunch of smaller birds following along, and the giant bird doesn't see them as much of a threat, or maybe they serve it in a positive way by like cleaning its nest of extra debris and little bits of creature that it itself can't eat. You kind of speculate along those lines. And I could go on about symbiosis, Dev. Before I do you want to like interrupt me before I go down this rabbit hole?
I've had like 8 thoughts that I was going to like chime in with, but then you kept saying interesting words. And they were more interesting than the words that I wanted to say. But I'm having
the Atlas Loom, where Diana says interesting words that are more interesting than whatever Dev is saying.
Summed it up. That's, we'll replace the show notes for that one. But I'm having flashes of like watching Planet Earth or whatever, and thinking about the, when you were talking about the having, you know, the shark and the little boys following it, and like the way that the patterns that they, the little guys, little boys, the patterns that these creatures inhabit and create. Birds and bottom of the sea dwelling fish do just some interesting shit with manipulating terrain. Like, ooh. Birds creating nests, but also they're like especially with more like jungly birds, they go hard. Like, they will make entire fucking productions and then invite a girl over and be like, "You like this good? Yeah?"
Bally
or like
birds.
Or like you've got that fish that like there's a some fish that makes like a perfect circle in the sand.
Yes.
And like makes sure that it is as perfect as possible. We'll take like anything that's like too big of a stone gets like sucked up and spat out of the circle. Can't have that. Gotta have uniform sand here. And they make a circle and they're like, "Hey, do you like my circle? I worked really hard on it." And like that can be used to, again, as a template to create a creature that leaves meaningful signs, like meaningful, I don't want to say not naturally occurring things, because it's occurring because of a natural process of an animal doing it, but stuff that you would come across, like a den or a big hole that was dug into the ground that like forks off in a whole bunch of different directions. And maybe, again, if you've got a druid character, they can shrink down to a small enough creature and pop in and see what's in there. They have agency in the world, right? They are mostly, like, most often animals are just used as set dressing. You've got horses in the stables, you've got birds flying overhead, you've got some sort of like war beasts on the field, but they don't need to be there. They don't need to even be a part of the scene to have left an impact on the environment. And there's a lot of room to work with there.
I have like 3 thoughts.
Please.
And this is going to be, I love how we're just like branching off into more and more thoughts that we'll never return to. Especially, and this is one of the few things that, how do I start this thought? Okay. Typically, when it comes to world building, I, as someone with OCPD, I try and make sure everything makes sense. The animal world is one of the few ways that I think different details in your world building doesn't have to necessarily make sense, and you can kind of hand wave it. So like you mentioned that bird, that fish that makes like the perfect circles. On the outside, why the fuck would a fish do that? The reason they do that is because genetically it's like tied to some other trait that is very desirable for whatever the, you know, opposite gender fish is coming up and seeing. So like a fish that can do a perfect circle, the gene that lets them do that or the traits that allow them to do that also are tied to positive things like they live longer, you know, or they are very good at hunting, or they have good, you know, coloration, which will like then, you know, make it so that their offspring also have really good chances of finding a mate, things like that. So you can hand wave a lot of the really small details when it comes to animals in your world, because that's You can just hand wave it and be like, ah, yeah, you know, it's just what the animal's like.
It's because natural selection.
It makes sense for breeding, you know?
Yeah, and yeah, it's because so, breeding.
Yeah, exactly. Because breeding. That should be the subtitle of this episode. Welcome back to the breeding episode of the Atlas Loom, ladies and gents. Buckle up.
See, I was already getting ready to make a joke about how I need to go step away to make a circle real quick. But then you went there, so all right.
Layers are also just such a cool concept. Like, the fact that in, you know, as written, most monster manuals, most bestiaries don't go into the details of what layers of different creatures looks like is such a crime. Like, part of the reason that I think dragons and rocks and things like that are so cool is because they have the most badass looking structures that you can then go in and like explore. Like, I mean, a rock's nest makes such a cool battleground. And so I implore you guys, if you are making your homebrew creatures, just like throw down a sentence or two saying what their lair or their home or their nest or whatever looks like. Even it's cute little flavor, you know, and if the creature is medium size or bigger, you know, the size of your characters are bigger, it's definitely important to try and throw that in because your characters are gonna ask. Like, it's basically an inevitability, and it makes your world seem more real, you know, because this thing doesn't just like, unless it's extremely nomadic, it's gonna have a home base.
And yeah, and it also gives you a bit of a hint as to how you can further incorporate that animal type. I don't mean to, okay, I originally thought of squirrels when I was thinking of this. I promise it wasn't just me talking or thinking about paleo more, but I was going to say animals, like you said, they have like a place that they go home that they live in. There's animals that live in like knots in like a hole of a tree, right? And if you are a, you know, if you're out in a forest or whatever and you bump into a tree or you, what's that spell? You're the D&D one. What's that spell where a druid can, like, walk through a tree like a portal?
Tree stride.
That. Like, you could maybe step out the other side and there's a squirrel on your head because you accidentally walked through a squirrel, like a squirrel in a hole. But in Palea, they recently introduced a new creature whose, like, mechanic, basically, is they look like a wolf, kind of. And they, when you try to hunt them down, they run to a tree and jump up into the tree. And the only way to get at them at that point is to chop the tree down and then continue to chase them as they run to another tree. And so it's mostly a mechanic just to give you a thing to do, like, you know, make it a little harder than just shoot this animal and collect its bounty. But they specifically made it so that, like, these creatures are, they have an affinity for trees. That's where they hide. When they're startled, they run and hide in a tree. And that is a defense mechanism that they have built up. And there is a mechanic you can do, chop the tree down, to get back to them. But that also works for both any kind of normal, like, just whatever fauna, as well as monsters. Monsters don't always need to fight to the death. In fact, most of them should probably have some notion of life preservation. When you think about animals in the wild, sparring or whatever, think about two whatever horned animals like goats or whatever that like are ramming into each other and they're like beating the hell out of each other, they don't necessarily always kill each other. Usually they beat the hell out of each other until one of them is like, I am going to die if I continue, I need to get out of here. Like, that is self-preservation. They don't always just say like, no matter what, I need to get this kill. They go away and they live another day. So they probably should have some kind of crafty method of escape if they're a wild beast, that they're going to opt for before just going into the death. I'm going to hit you with,
oh boy,
what I think might be the ultimate in inspiration for designing animals and how they interact with not just the like their environment, but also society. Pokemon.
Yeah, is now a good time to say that I haven't really played the Pokemon games either?
I mean, I have come to assume.
Yeah.
But
sorry,
like,
audience.
You are aware of Pokemon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the show, the games, whatever, like, there are so many Pokemon that have so many wild ass abilities. You know, they're all like literally magic, and some of them are creatures and some of them are an actual like just flying magnet or a,
like,
just,
isn't there a keychain?
Yeah. Or okay, one of them is a literal sword that evolves into a sword and a shield. Like, they're a little out there sometimes, but they establish in the Pokemon universe, and I'm sorry for anybody who's listening, I know it's like Pokemon. I know you're supposed to say E or whatever. Pokemon. I'm going to say Pokemon. They're established in the universe as part of society. They work in factories, like doing things that are otherwise virtually impossible for a human to do. If one of them has like electricity powers, they can charge stuff up. There are all sorts of like, oh, this Pokemon, which can shoot water. It works on a farm and it helps to water the crops because it like has the water gun ability and that's what it does. Or welcome to the beach. We've got a whole bunch of Pokemon that you can ride on the water because they are essentially like a water horse that you can just go out on an adventure on. And they become a part of the utility of the world. It's very similar to having a world where like magic is running rampant and like everybody just has like spells to do everything. But instead of channeling magic directly, you are leveraging the abilities of these unique creatures. You know, you're probably not going to have that in most worlds where most creatures are just kind of chilling and surviving. But in a world where creatures have inherent magic abilities, or if it's like a monster that's not necessarily evil and has a, like, you know, can be domesticated or is assimilated into society, or maybe accidentally is benefiting society through some process that they're doing otherwise that we don't care about, i.e. clams making pearls, they have an impact.
Oh, yeah. And that kind of goes into something that we'll touch on more in the towns and villages episode that we do down the line. But that is kind of thinking about animals in terms of how they evolve alongside humans, right? If you think about very similarly how wolves evolved into dogs because they filled a specific role in human society.
That role being a very good boy.
Just the best boy. And you can think about, for example, how your village's traits have grown up around the creatures that are in the area. So maybe everyone in the highest parts of a certain society wears a certain cloak made by a certain creature. What is that creature? Is it hard to find or is it easy to find? Do you have to fight the creature in order to acquire their skin in order to make the cloak, and that's what gets you to elevated status? Maybe people use parts of animals in their tools. So some society out there has incredibly strong weaponry or tools because they use the bones of some incredibly strong creature that is in the area. That being said, when you think about it in terms of like their role in society, that also gives you automatic plot hooks with regards to what happens when that creature disappears. Ooh. If that society is dependent on that creature and that creature is suddenly endangered, either due to environmental changes, the actions of a BBEG, invasive species, going back to that thought we had earlier, then you have something to give your party to do when they enter that area.
I think another really great example of integrating a creature, like a fantasy creature, into a world and like depending on it would come from, and now this one I'm a little tenuous on, but I'm fairly certain I know what it is. Final Fantasy has a concept of, it's a recurring item. I believe it's in like every Final Fantasy game. It's the Phoenix Down. So it's the down feather of a phoenix that is essentially a revive. You know, not that big of a logical leap, right? But phoenixes, pretty common fantasy creature. They've got reincarnation built in. It's like to their genetics, if you want to call it that. And like, yeah, you can harvest these properties of these creatures. Hopefully ethically. I would hope that it's ethically harvested Phoenix Down, but who knows? The reason that I originally brought up Pokemon, and I am really like reaching into the depths of vague memories of an episode of the anime that I saw as a child. I think there's an episode where it doesn't matter. There's a set piece where there is a like glowing big stone in a field somewhere, and a whole bunch of a specific type of Pokemon all gather at that thing to basically perform a ritual. I think they all like evolve together, little culty almost, but the idea being that creatures as a community, if you think like elephants or any kind of like pack animal or any animal that lives for a while and learns about how to interact with their surroundings, they will have a space that they go to, like a routine where maybe once a year they just know to go to this space to do a thing. It's just migration. Instinctual migration, yes, but also like I mean, maybe I'm just talking about migration, but I'm thinking I'm thinking about is like elephants going to when there's like when summer hits and like water becomes extraordinarily scarce, and elephants remember for like decades where to find water when it's scarce. And so they like make their way that way. I don't know if it's, I guess that's migration. Is that migration?
I hate to be the one to tell you this, Dev, that you're just describing migration. But that is a really good point.
I just thought it was going on a little water trip, going on a little water run.
It's just a little water break.
It's yeah, just I said 10,000 mile water break. Well, no, is it 10,000 miles? No, I'm talking, okay.
I don't know, I think distances.
So here's the thing. I am, between the two of us, I'm the one that knows the most about animals and zoology. And
right,
I think that migration is when bird go, right? My bird go up in sky and then out far. That's migration, right?
Yeah.
When elephant just take a quick hop, skip, and jump to go drink some water, that's just heading down to the tavern, baby.
Uh-huh. My soul hurts.
Yeah, I'm out of my element.
Anyway, this episode is sponsored by the movie Migration, which is out in theaters right now. What is that even about? I have not looked at movies in like fucking...
it's about Pokemon going to a field where there's a big shiny crystal and evolving.
Speaking about evolution, another interesting thing to think about when you're thinking about, you know, either animals or just straight up regular monsters or even humans, like this applies to pretty much anything that lives, is that pretty much its entire evolutionary existence and the reason it has any traits that it does, except for creatures that were created in a lab or whatever, or created by the gods, which is always a good throwaway if you're like, I have no idea where this animal fits in the evolutionary tree.
Created by the gods like me.
All right. Then you can always just be, you hand wave it by saying, oh yeah, those deities, man, they just threw out some shit one day. Now we have owlbears. But in general, you want to think about your creatures as reactionary to other creatures that it directly is involved with. Prey and predators are a really good example of this. Any prey creature is going to have adaptations that help it evade predatory creatures. So for example, rabbits burrow because it's a lot harder for prey, or it's a lot harder for predatory animals to pick up their scent and things like that when they're underground and hiding. And
is that
those little
actually
tents.
Why?
It's like, it's a really good example if it is true. I can find an actual example.
I'm not challenging you. I'm saying I didn't even think about scent being a thing that is masked by burrowing. That it makes sense. I'll accept it. But that's fascinating.
I think it's also like what else are they going to do?
Yeah, sure. Until a stoat comes along and just fucking destroys them.
There's better examples. But that being said, creatures who are predatory are going to try and evolve around that. They're going to learn to dig. They're going to learn to have better senses of smell. They're going to try and be ambush predators so they can catch the rabbits on the way out. Things like that. A better example is like seals. You know, they tunnel into the ice and ice is this a touchy subject?
No, I'm shocked. What?
Yeah. This is what happens whenever I talk about animals. Fucking buckle up, audience. So
hell
seals,
yeah.
Right?
Hello, it's me. I'm the audience.
And this is a very, very easy to grasp concept as far as what's that I have in my head right now. So hopefully this lands. But seals, they make dens because they can't just swim all the time. You know, they lose energy really quickly, and energy is hard to come by in every environment. Basically, it's a constant fight for survival. And so in order to preserve energy, they have these little dens built into functionally the underside of ice floes. And that is where they rest. That is where they raise their babies, their pups. In adaptation to that, polar bears, since they also can't swim forever, but they also have a hard time tracking seals when they're in water, have adapted to this strategy where they will try and listen or like sniff out where those seal dens will be just underneath the surface of an ice floe. And then they'll go up to it. They'll sneak up. And they will full on like jump and slam themselves down to break down into the seal den and then yank.
Turn down
seal.
For what? Holy shit. Wait a minute. That's amazing.
I'm gonna fact check this real quick. But yeah, so they either break down into the seal den or they like just wait and ambush the seal. One of the two. But they have to, you know, they've had to adapt that strategy, because the seals adapted a strategy to evade the polar bears. And so it's a constant battle of fighting to be on top and constantly developing new strategies over very long periods of time to survive. that basic principle applies to fantasy creatures. You know, I had someone come out and make a homebrew creature not too long ago that was a predator to the Tarrasque, because they were thinking to themselves, like, man, a Tarrasque has like spikes on the all along its spine and along its back. Why the fuck does it have those spikes? And so they came up with this like flying creature that would prey on the Tarrasque as a sort of like counterbalance to it. And so kind of taking any trait of any creature that you come up with and thinking like, why does it have that? Like, what is it protecting itself against? Or what is it trying to hunt down in order to survive? And using that as like a branch of thought to create a similar creature or a creature that interacts with it in its environment. That is a very easy way to, if you're looking at doing this from scratch, build out functionally like a food web for yourself.
I hate the idea of a creature that preys on a Tarrasque. It makes me think about like a bird that's so big that it preys on purple worms.
Yeah. Oh my God, dude. What a concept. Holy shit. That'd be cool. I want to build that now.
I'm going to be doing a, we recently hit a stream goal on my stream to do designing like homebrew shit, like stat blocks and stuff. So we'll see. As we were talking about icy boys on lines of seals and polar bears, they all, in terms of the animal kingdom, they fall under the kingdom of icy boys. It got me thinking about the fact that you've got fish in like Arctic waters who develop a like thick layer of like fatty tissue to insulate, right? And then you've got Norway, which is a fantasy world that exists, and they eat a lot of fish, and that's just like their diet is fatty fish, but like they get a ton of fish oil because of that. And because of that, like, Norwegians are one, hot, and two, like, have really good cardiovascular health. And that gets into the diet of a local area based on the animals that are available there, based on the climate and how that has shaped the animals and their availability. That is fucking rad. And that I don't want to get too much into the town and village designing stuff, but having areas where people's way of life is based on the fauna around them, like that's how humans do. That's how mortals are, is we need to feed ourselves typically, and whatever is available is what we do, and we make the best of it. And so that might be super beneficial, like having a lot of like really good, like healthy, vitamin rich stuff. Or it could be you just don't have a lot. You're working with scraps, but you find a way to make that excellent. The real world has a lot of examples of people taking just what's around them and making the best of it that might come to a head where it becomes a cuisine, right? Like a delicacy, like a thing that people now today see as like, wow, I would love to eat that. A great example would be like lobster, right? Where like lobster used to be just the pits. Like it's a bug, right? It's like sea bug. And people ate it because that's what they were able to afford. But they made the best of it, and they learned how to cook with it, and they learned to make cuisine with it. And now it's a delicacy. Now it's a thing that you pay a premium for, and then you go to specific places just to get it. And it didn't start that way. It's just a fact of the availability of that food and how it impacted over the course of generations, how it changed the way that the people in the area interacted with the world.
Did you know lobsters live forever functionally?
That's a thing, right? Yeah, they're like,
their telomeres don't shorten, and so they can, as long as they can continue to shed their exoskeleton and like have the energy to do that, which is usually like the stopping point,
sure,
they can grow basically forever. There are lobsters somewhere out there the size of golden retrievers.
Yeah, I remember reading about like research into trying to basically make like a tincture out of lobster to reverse aging or whatever.
Oh yeah, we're gonna be about that for a while. But
lobster tincture.
The point of this all being, everything is a consequence of everything else, audience. And I've said this like three different times on this podcast, but if you take away anything at all from the Atlas Loom, the key to being a good world builder, here it is: evolution and consequences and adaptation. just think along those lines, and I promise you it makes world building so much easier because you're thinking on a timeline and you're not just trying to come up with all these random little scattered concepts completely originally by yourself all the time.
I think it's another point in the favor of, and I know we say this all the time, but it's another point in the favor of asking questions as a method of world building. Again, we've said it at the outset. What is the area? What is the landscape? And given that landscape, what kind of creatures would populate it? And then given those creatures, how does that impact the local population? Be it humanoids or not, how does that impact those higher up on the food chain? It very well could be a situation where, as Diana mentioned, we're at like Tarrasque levels of prey versus predator. Or it could be it's a relatively safe space and the apex predator is some sort of humanoid that is bending the local area to their will. But even in a scenario where there's the massive, massive predators that are way bigger than anything that we know in this world, that doesn't erase the lower level literal groundwork being done by the smallest of creatures, the worms that are recycling the soil and making it more nutrient rich, or the bugs that are feeding the smaller creatures that aren't necessarily like, I guess if you're a creature that eats bugs, you're a predator, technically.
Yes.
Like a possum is a predator, I guess.
Yep.
Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to say is biology, and this is true, is complex. I might be the first person ever to realize this.
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely are. I should have had my fucking degree on in the background of this video this entire time. That would have been such a good bit.
I would have doxed
the shit out of me, but I swear I would have been good. Just slowly reach for it.
Dear listener and or viewer, I am realizing that it's not mansplaining necessarily. It's more, I'm realizing just how much Diana is sitting there being like, yeah, fucking doy.
No, while I'm to be like, fair, this is also a very complex topic that we're breaking down into easy steps for the audience here. And it's not an easy thing to do. You know, you're doing fantastic. Now
I'm doing good job.
Yeah, good work. Great job.
Good job. Pat. You're doing great.
Up to this point, we've talked a lot about creatures, assuming we're thinking about like animals, because that's what we have in the real world. And it's easy to take those traits and bring them into a fantasy world. But of course, everything we just said also applies to monsters, like we were talking about the Tarrasque and things like that. So building monsters is going to be largely the same as building animals, with the exception, of course, of that weird eldritch shit, stuff that's made in a lab, stuff that's made by the gods, things like that. But luckily, when it comes to world building those, you don't have to do too much work. You can literally just hand wave it by saying like, oh, yeah, some wizard out there got real weird with like
got real nasty with it.
They mixed a praying mantis with a fucking tiger, and now we've got this fucking thing. And so that can be done in like 1 to 2 sentences. Same with eldritch creatures. You can just be like, oh yeah, they came from space, or like, oh, we have no idea where they came from. But generally, if you want to create like a monster with history, try and approach it the same way, you know, where you have that sort of, how did it evolve to get to the way it is? What's its role in the world? How does it interact with other creatures? How does it eat?
Again, a point in the favor of The Witcher, the world of The Witcher. Like, they are so good with designing creatures that are monsters and saying like, oh, it's currently attacking this town because of this property of it, that like it needs to do this or whatever. They don't just say it's evil, so it's hurting everybody. It's like, the point of witchers is we understand the impulses of these creatures and what they're doing, what they feed on, what their patterns are, what their nature is, and we strike based on that. And in the books, in the game, a lot of the like, there's this horrifying creature that is like fucking with everybody's day up. It's not just doing it for the fun of it. It's never just doing it for the fun of it. It's trying to survive. It's trying to run from something else. It's trying to eat. And largely they're just portrayed as just scared animals, even though they're monsters, you know?
Oh yeah. Very similar to what we touched on with the BBG episode, where it's like everything has a motivation beyond just I'm doing this for the fun of it. Thinking about that in terms of animals is just as easy as thinking like, okay, what would it do in its natural environment? And what is in the way of it doing that right now? and what is replacing what it would naturally do that to. Mm-hmm. So super easy plot hooks. And you can build entire campaigns based around one or two central animals in that sort of sense. Speaking of building, we're going to get to the meat of the episode. We're going to talk about how you actually create a creature, a animal, a monster, and kind of give you some basic tools to do that the easy way, as opposed to just like fucking slamming your head against your keyboard, looking at a blank Word document like we've all done so many times before.
Is that not the easy way?
No.
Oh.
I mean, if you want to go the real easy way, yoink it. I talked about this a little bit during the stealing and, you know, stealing but not plagiarizing, you know, stealing and crediting your sources episode, where I talked about looking at like Magic the Gathering cards, going to scryfall.com, just literally hitting random and looking at a random magic card and turning that into a creature. A lot of magic cards are based on animals or fantasy monsters that you can pull into your world really easily and give it a stat block. Beyond that, though, you can also kind of modify an existing creature. This is all just going to be callbacks to previous episodes, but if you remember the body horror episode, which you should also go watch, one of the ways that I created new fantastical creatures that had this sort of body horror aspect was modifying very specific things about them, you know, the number of limbs, the composition of their limbs, where their limbs were placed on their body. You can do the same thing with animals and monsters, you know, just make it a little less fleshy and horrifying. So
just slap some fur on it. You'll be fine. Put more fur on it. It'll be cute instead of horrifying.
I mean, basically, like, you can splice monsters together. An owlbear is a fucking owl and a bear. Like, that's where the bar is at. So you can do whatever you want.
Okay, I will say on that subject, I know you haven't seen this, but in the Avatar universe, every creature is a hybrid creature. Every single creature is something hyphen something. There are, like, instead of horses, they have, like, emu horses that they always ride. So it's just, like, 2 feet. And they're just, like, riding on this, like, bird horse thing.
That sounds terrifying.
It's to the point that, like literally everything is a hybrid. And it's to the point that there's a gag later on where the king of the Earth Kingdom has a pet bear. And everyone's like, you mean platypus bear? You mean...
Really?
What's a bear? Like they go through all the different combination bears, but it's just like it just says bear, and they're all like confused by this, and it's just like the only like literal bear in the world. Everything else is two animals squished together.
Oh, fucking wild! But yeah, that would be like baby steps type creating a creature.
Yeah.
Just pull bits that you like from other creatures.
Yeah,
I think one step above that in creativity is taking a creature that already exists in the game and modifying some elemental aspect of it or some kind of like core version of it. We talked a little bit about purple worms earlier, for example, right? Those already exist in D&D. What about other colors of worms? Do they exist in different environments? What if you take a purple worm that exists in normally a desert environment and you put it in a forest? Is it a green worm? What if
a
you have one that's
worm?
Like moving through, sorry?
A mauve worm?
Mauve, a puce worm.
Chartreuse worm?
Yeah. A rainbow worm that only comes out in June.
The fucking trans pride worm. Oh my god.
Oh. But put it in a different environment. Think a little bit about how that different environment would change its adaptations, like we talked about earlier. So maybe there's like a lava worm and it's resistant to fire damage and it's red. It's as simple as that. That's like the next step. You can do the same with like, and this is so simple, damage types. And, you know, so What's that guy in D&D that shoots lightning out of its mouth? Is it a Bahir?
Yes.
So take that, make it acid or something instead, something that's not lightning, and boom, you've increased your repertoire of creatures.
Not me searching Bahir to make sure that I'm not about to get fucking steamrolled by, yeah,
it's
lightning
either
breath.
That or a salamander.
It's Bahir, like, yeah.
Sick. We are good. Look at us. Fucking, we're D&D content creators.
I've DM'd. I did that once.
Right.
I did that once a lot.
God. And that kind of goes into like the whole concept of families of creatures. And like, oh, man, this is a slight nerd tangent. But back when I was first starting to DM, and I still have this urge to this day as someone with this fucking degree that I can't do shit about, is I've wanted to make like map out all the creatures in the monster manual that aren't the product of the gods or some sort of experimentation and put it into like a full on evolutionary tree.
I like that.
And just like put all the oozes together, you know, and figure out which gods created which creatures and make a whole like splaying. You have obsidian. This is my thing. Okay. This is my fucking.
Put all the pieces together.
Yeah.
All the different, the genus of gelatinous cubes.
Yeah. Cause yes, exactly. Dude. And then like the whole dragonkin thing, and how they whittle down into kobolds, if they even whittle down to kobolds at all. Total just, oh, just the.
You said kobold.
The urge has always been there.
That is triggering me to say a thing that I actually do have in my notes.
Yeah.
It's not kobolds, but I just kind of, these two are very, very similar to me in my head. Gnolls. So gnolls are essentially, at least in the D&D universe, I believe they're hyenas that got more or less like cursed and are now like fucked up. And it is literally a monster made out of a creature. That's a nice little marriage of the topics we're talking about here, of designing. If you have an area that has a whole lot of a given type of creature, and then maybe you mix in a little bit of some shitty wizard did something, and now there is a curse or a disease or whatever that permeates through this population that can cause them to transform from some relatively inconsequential animal into a serious danger of a monster.
Dude, oh, that makes me think of like, and especially because gnolls are so cannibalistic and that's kind of what makes them a whole thing. Thinking about like humans and how they turn into wendigos and things like that. And thinking about the mythology of that creature's genesis. Oh, so cool.
We need to be careful because we could probably do an entire different episode on cryptids now that I think about it.
Yeah. Yep. It would just evolve into another. That's just like the level of hype that I got about the horror episode married with the level of hype that I'm getting about this episode. It's just going to be, it's going to be me sitting in a room and just talking to myself and being like, and another point.
Just, I'm now picturing an episode of The Outlast Loom. It's just Diana sitting on the floor in a dark room, just rocking to herself, being like, but Wendigos though, we need to talk about the Wendigos now.
Anyway, thinking about creatures and closely related creatures and trying to bridge that gap is such a cool way of going about things. In a similar vein, and this is probably something that's even more advanced than just switching up, you know, some of the limb numbers or the elements or the biomes that a certain creature lives in to make a new creature. Something else that you can do is think about a real life animal or some sort of fact of nature and take a single trait from it and use that as the seed for an idea for a new creature. So, for example, this is going to be an obscure one, but there's this really cool tree out there, and I've tried to search for the name. I cannot for the life of me come up with it, but it's a real tree, and it's kind of, I believe it's related to mistletoe or is similarly parasitic, and it looks totally mundane, but it does this thing where the roots will dig down and then across to find the roots of a different nearby tree, and when it finds another tree's roots, it will wrap around that root like a fucking, like a loop, squeeze, and then the parasitic tree will develop these like basically like needle type growths that start to slice into the other root, and they will chop through it, and then the parasitic tree will then basically siphon away the nutrients from that victim tree's roots. And it's actually a problem because these trees will go down and they'll like sever power lines and or like underground cables and things like that. So taking that as a concept and making it into a creature, right? You can think about that sort of guillotine type aspect and think of a monster that has tentacles that do the same thing. Like its entire battle strategy is to wrap around something and then over the course of several turns, slice into it. And that right there is, you have a battle strategy. Now you just have to figure out what it looks like.
One, horrifying. Two, yeah. Nature's metal as hell.
It is. Never, if you guys...
Forget that.
Part of the reason I'm such an animal nerd is because when I was a kid, I read this one book called Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You. It's by Dan Riskin. It's my favorite book in the world. And if any of you guys are budding animal nerds out there, it's not high level. It's not technical at all. It literally just talks about different animals in the, you know, the real world animals. Not talking about fantasy here. Scary as shit, real animals. And it breaks it down into categories based on the seven deadly sins.
Ooh.
And it talks about them in terms of like, you know, like the wrath chapter is all about creatures that will do absolutely horrible things for the sake of hunting or even just for fun. It's so cool. And just talking about the adaptations that those creatures have. And it's very, very approachable, very easy. And honestly, it's fucking hilarious as a book, too. highly recommend. Great inspo. But yeah, you can take a bunch of traits like that. Like if you look at a frog's poisonous skin, take that, use that as the nucleus for a creature. Bioluminescence is really good, or maybe attraction to light, the same way that moths have. Some creature, just fucking go to Wikipedia, click around a little bit on different genuses, wait till it spits out a creature, and then try and find some trait of it that makes it unique or even just mildly interesting. Separate that out and build a creature around it. That's what I like to do.
I'm now just picturing like some adventurers, they're sitting around a campfire, and the Mothman shows up just because he's attracted to the light of the campfire.
Just sits down and he's like, what are you guys up to?
Just like, very bright. I like this.
One other piece of advice that I have is you can make entire like trees of creatures by thinking about the different like life forms of it. So for example, if you have like the spawn version of a creature, like the larva, and then think about like the adult form, and then maybe like the hive mother version of it. That's how we got the idea of mimic colonies, you know, like in the OG D&D, there was just mimics, but nowadays we have mimics of different sizes and, you know, whole house size fucking mimics on the other end of things. So kind of thinking about it on a scale of colonies is always a pretty solid idea. And thinking like, okay, well, what form of this creature would be best suited for different roles within that colony to support the colony? You can create entire fucking dungeons of creatures that way. I think it's a lot of fun as a little thought exercise.
So on the topic of actually like trying, like designing the creatures, if I'm not intentionally trying to make a like humanoid, you know, horrifying monster kind of thing, and I'm just trying to make this is a creature that is dangerous, I usually just start with some normal ass animal, right? Like take, as you said, like the property of something, take the fact that you've got like, what is it? Is it cheetahs or jaguars that are the fastest land animal?
Cheetahs.
Okay. So like take the cheetah, right? The fact that it's faster than you. It's almost definitely faster than you. And translate that into a, you know, that's the basis of whatever you're building. Okay, this thing is incredibly quick. What does it gain from being incredibly quick? What is it able to do because it's incredibly quick? What can it outpace in the local area? And given that, how has that shaped the way that people interact with the area, the way that animals in the nearby area just sort of go about their day? We talked about rabbits burrowing underground to get away from predators. What do other creatures who cannot run do? And then what is its weakness? Because if it can run super, super fast, that's great and all, that's super powerful, but if other creatures can still maintain their existence around this thing, that means that it can be defeated. Defeating it might mean going underground or going up in a tree, but if it's just got I'm fast as its main thing, that still has limitations. Like ground is still its limitation. You can then make, as you were saying, a more advanced version of it that maybe has wings or is adapted to climbing trees or can mountain goat it up and just like walk up borderline a sheer cliff. You can build, you have your like base level spooky boy, and then you can build on top of that these sort of advanced tiers of spooky boy. I really like what you said about the colony of mimics and having like a dungeon that just has varying degrees of a given monster, because that is also, to some degree, how herds of animals can function. You've got the babies who, depending on the animal, could maybe still kind of fuck you up a little bit. And then you've got the big old, I need to protect the pack, you know, mamas and papas who will skewer you on a moment's notice to protect their young. There's a big range there. And when you get into the world of having, you know, one, the paintbrush or being able to do whatever you want, and two, magic, it can be more than just here is a small rhinoceros and here is a big rhino. Actually, no, fuck that. Here's a small hippo and a big hippo, because hippos are much scarier than rhinoceri.
Hippos will fuck you up.
A big hippo is scarier than any fantasy creature I can think of, actually. But a hippo with wings, that's actually scarier. But yeah, you don't have to limit yourself to just like cubs and adults. You can have variations of them. You can have elemental variations of them. You can have environmental variations of them. You can have a jungle version of a creature, a desert version of a creature, a sky version of a creature, hell, a space version of a creature. And all of them could, as Diana alluded to, like, come from sort of the same tree, right? Like, they could maybe, if you really wanted to have that history of, like, they all have a common ancestor and were put into these different environments and therefore had to adapt, and that's why this version of it has wings, this version of it is a, like, pale brown to fit in with the sand dunes or whatever. Like, they all will get their different traits for whatever adaptive reasoning, or because you wanted them to have those traits because it's your world.
There's a really cool concept in biology which mostly applies to colonies of creatures, where you can think about, for instance, ants or bees. There's the queen, there's workers, there's drone, you know, the ones that are just larvae and kind of useless, and then there's ones that defend the nest. Very simple way to think about different niches within a single colony. There's also real life examples of functionally, what are those rocks that you use to evolve something in Pokemon?
There's just like various stones, like moonstone, sunstone, some of that.
They have that in real life with bees. You feed a certain bee a certain jelly and it unlocks certain parts of their genome and locks other parts of their genome.
So bee drill is a real thing, is what you're saying.
Functionally, yeah. And it turns it into like a queen bee.
Damn.
So like the bees kind of choose.
A piece of advice I would give just at large when creating monsters or just types of enemies in general is to make those variations, is to make variants. When I'm designing like a faction of, even if it's just like humanoid enemies, I will usually have a like base stat block and then like several variants, you know, the brute variant, the magic variant, the ranged variant, the whatever variant. And you can do the same thing with any kind of like creature or monster or whatever. Just start with that base stat block of here's just the creature, and then here are all of my different versions of it. And you could really just come up with any noun to put in front of them, the blank variant of them, the light dark variant, the void variant, the incorporeal variant, the ghastly variant, like really anything goes. And, you know, obviously literally anything goes, it's your world, but that is a really easy way to start with a basic concept, adapt it 18 different ways. And for 99% of the time, I would say that I end up not using those, but realizing that a different creature would be better suited for this like variation I'm going for. And that opens up a whole new like fractal of designing new creatures. And like, again, I know I say this every time, I just hop the hell around. And the second I get an idea, I just pounce on it and try to get it out and see where it takes me. You can always do that when you're designing these kind of things.
Oh yeah, play Mad Libs with your monsters.
Mm-hmm. So I know, Diana, that you are like a specialist when it comes to animals and the kingdoms they're in, but what if they didn't have a body? What about monsters that are less animal and more spooky? Just kind of like ghosts, interdimensional or otherwise, creatures that are in the given world but aren't just engaging with nature as we know it here. I really like to play in the space of otherworldly, or I don't want to just say eldritch, that's not accurate enough, but incorporeal creatures, things that are conscious, that still have agency, but aren't just a sort of naturally occurring animal, or not. It could be naturally occurring insofar as they just exist regardless of anything. They're not the result of some magician doing something, but they are navigating this world just as any other animal would, but you can't touch them. You can't see or smell. I think about like spirits or an animal that can like inhabit another animal, or not an animal, a monster that can basically take over another creature and temporarily possess it, more or less. Maybe leave it as a husk. Maybe it's parasitic insofar as like it's sort of like that fungus that causes ants to go kill themselves or whatever, but instead of a fungus. Yeah. But instead of a fungus, it's a spirit or just some essence that is a part of nature and has an impact on these ecosystems. Oftentimes we think about ghosts or incorporeal or interdimensional or other planes as just being these isolated things, but you can really weave them into ecosystems and you open up a lot of opportunity there. I'm a big fan of, as I said, possession. We're big fans of possession here
at
the
Island.
We love possession here at the Island.
Repossession.
Yeah.
All the time.
I'm all about it. I really like hiding stuff in animals by way of there is something that is in this creature and it requires you to be paying attention, or maybe you need to do a decent animal handling check, or maybe if you were speaking with animals, this one's wrong. And or maybe it's causing trouble within the local ecosystem, destabilizing the local ecosystem because it is inhabiting animals, causing them to act differently. Even if it's not trying to be malicious, it's probably just trying to sustain itself. Maybe it's a creature that exists and the only way it can't not be in an animal for an extended period of time because it like dries out from the sun. Like the sun is able to destroy this spirit if it's just exposed. So it has to jump from animal to animal, and in doing so is just leaving a trail of chaos. In a way, I mean, that's, as you were talking about, like, it's a parasitic relationship. It is a impactful thing. Or it could be the cause of bringing species to new places. It could cause the species to have migration patterns that it wouldn't otherwise do. Birds flying in the wrong direction, animals running way far from their habitat and showing up in places they shouldn't be, and then getting left there and becoming invasive or becoming a mystery. What the hell is this thing doing here? How did it get here? It opens up so much intrigue. It opens up so much just space to play when you start working with, like, do my creatures need a body?
Fucking love parasites, dude. Not enough people make parasites. And there's so many cool parasites in real life that you could adapt from, too. It's just, oh, so good and such an unfilled role when it comes to tabletop games and the bestiaries that come with them. So good.
You said there's so many good parasites, or so many parasites that you could pull from the world. The only thing that came to mind, like the first thing that came to mind, was landlords.
I was just going to say landlords.
So when we're talking about building the true scariest monster, landlords are great inspiration.
When it comes to the Atlas Loom, I do try and give you guys like a couple basic questions that you can ask yourself, because like we've said several times, it really is just a process of asking yourself things. And when it comes to the creatures that you build, you can kind of boil it down to at least a couple different questions that you probably should answer if you can. For example, like we've talked about plenty here, how does the creature's environment and challenges dictate its looks, its behavior, how it's evolved over time? You can also think about, how does it eat? Rust monsters in D&D are a really good example of something that has a strange sort of pattern of eating that makes it realistically a nuisance, but also it contributes to how you fight it. Owlbear pellets being found in random spots near campsites or near towns is a really good example of kind of the remnants of a creature based off of the way that it eats. You can also look at like the actual methods that it uses. So for example, is an ambush predator, does it chase things down? Does it dig underneath and then pop up through the surface, which is a very fancy ambush predator functionally?
Only the fanciest ambush predators will dig underground.
Yeah.
That's advanced.
Is it a scavenger, for example? There's a lot of different predation methods or eating methods, so you can use that as a question that you should answer. How do their senses contribute to how they eat? Which, if you're looking at stat blocks and things like that, and kind of boiling it down to, okay, like, I have a concept, I need to make sure that it's got stats to go with it. Its senses are something you're going to want to look at. Is it mostly digging underground, so therefore it has like tremor sense? Is it something that has really good hearing because the thing that it chases is usually really quiet and it had to adapt to that? That is kind of what will help you translate it into a usable, statable creature in your game as well.
I want to interject and just say that what you just described, for whatever reason, the image I put in my head is how, is it, I don't remember what reptile it is, or maybe it's a bunch of them, that have that like eye on the top of their head. and its sole purpose is to detect shadow.
Yes.
Because it is looking to see if it's about to get swooped.
Yeah. And it's not just reptiles. There's a lot of creatures that have, like, not really an eye, but just like a straight up organ or cell that just detects the presence or absence of light, kind of like a light switch.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
It's yeah. Awesome. Like shit like that, that you can put onto your creatures. And it's like, you're not usually thinking like you have the senses. Like we are usually limited to what we think of as senses. Like it's not necessarily looking at you, but it could be looking away from you. But maybe it has something that it's not seeing you from behind, but it's alerted to your presence. By way of, even if you thought that you were so sneaky, but you cast a slight shadow and that tripped its like defense mechanism, that tripped its thing that it has grown to have.
Oh, yeah.
To survive.
Can get real fancy with it. So that's another thing that you can ask yourself. Another one is, what is its social structure like, or does it even have one? And you can go as simple as, is it solitary? Does it work in groups? How does it mate? Does it mate and then the two mates instantly like break apart and never talk to each other again? Or is there like a family, like hierarchy, a colony of some sort?
Or is it metal as hell and bites off its mate's head after they're done?
Yeah, do that. Please do that. That's so cool. Do that. So how does it interact with its own kind? And then how does it interact with other creatures in the same space? And it doesn't have to be a predatory or prey sense. Like straight up, does it tolerate other creatures at the same watering hole? Is it parasitic, symbiotic, you know, things like that? We kind of brushed on that a little bit earlier. And then a fun one that is kind of optional, but I recommend you answer this question to integrate it better into your world, is, what do local people believe about the creature? What do people who are learned scholars who have studied the creature know about it? What do locals who haven't necessarily studied the creature, but who have grown up with it and like integrated into their society, believe about it? Do they think it's some sort of holy creature? Do they think it's a nuisance? What are their thoughts? And what about people who saw it for the first time? What would someone who's new to the area think about this? Kind of in the same way that I imagine the settlers of America fucking took a look at, there's like this story where someone took a look at some creature and was like, oh my God, that's a mythical animal. And I forget exactly what the example is.
I hope it's a turkey. Like just the fucking dumbest looking, gobbliest turkey.
So those are just some basic questions you can answer for yourself. And that already is going to form a really good basis for your creature and give you really good ideas as to how to turn it into a stat block. And when you do so, chances are you can just, and this is a little lazy DM life hack, fucking just take an existing stat block and reskin it. I've done that so many times, like taking an existing stat block and switching out like a single sense for a different sense, upping a stat, downing a stat, changing the color of the creature, the element that it uses to attack. And then I'm like, oh, look at this brand new creature that I made. It looks totally different. I made this. in D&D, actually, there's a very easy way you could do it. I think the Dungeon Master's Guide actually gives you a format for creating stat blocks by cobbling together other stat blocks. Like if you have a monster of a certain challenge rating, you can look at other monsters with the exact same challenge rating. And one for one, you can switch out any of its stat block abilities or traits for any other. And then that maintains the difficulty level of the creature. Like as long as you do it one for one, you still have the same CR. So you can kind of cobble together a creature like that.
That's pretty sick.
Anyway, we've given you the tools. You got everything you need to build an environment and the fauna to populate it with. So let's go ahead and move on to weaving some wishes.
Wishes.
Wishes. For those who aren't aware, we have a segment of the podcast where we answer your guys' questions. And in order to submit a question, you can email them in to wish@theatlasloom.com. And we may feature it on the episode and kind of make it a teaching moment for everyone. This first one today comes from Abigail, who uses she, her pronouns. And very simple one. Thank you so much, Abby. It just says, what are some good ways to integrate new players into an ongoing campaign? Do I do a session zero to figure out what they've been doing while the campaign has already started, like in that interim period? Are there other ideas that you have? What are your thoughts, Deb?
There's so much you could do. It really comes down to where you're at in your campaign and what the basic premise of your party is. For example, one of the most difficult things, and I think every DM runs into this at some point when they've got some beautiful plot in their head and then a character dies or a new player joins and they're like, shit, what do I do? Which is the chosen heroes thing, where it's like your party, the main party, are the chosen heroes of destiny. They are the ones of that are fated to do whatever. And then your friend wants to join the campaign and you're like, and them too, they're also a chosen hero of destiny. And like, that is just a thing that I know that's not the question, but avoid that, because that just writes you into a corner and it makes it all the more difficult to bring people into an ongoing campaign. But really, really great ways to go about actually doing that is to just work with the player who is joining your table, determine what kind of character they want to run before they, if they already have an entire character ready, you can try to work with them on fitting it, you know, retrofitting it into a position. But take an NPC who is integral to the next major plot point and just swap them out to be a player character. If you have an NPC that you know that the party needs to go to get something or to advance the plot, or even if that character doesn't exist, you can just invent it. Direct the party to a plot relevant character who can be played by a player and tag along for a bit until they end up becoming deeply ingrained into the party. It is incredibly difficult to just say, here's a new person, you should care about them. And I get that. And as much as you can, just ask your party to hand wave it and say, screw it, just accept that this person's here, which is perfectly fine. If you want to actually weave them into the story, using an existing touchstone that you were planning on having happen anyway, or having them be a contact of some previously established NPC that's like, you really should meet my friend Steve. He's really great at turning into a bird sometimes. And then Steve is the player character. I guess Steve's a druid. We love Steve here.
We love druids here, she says as a druid maid. Yeah. You hit on all the points I was going to. Really, it's just a matter of making sure, and this has to do with any sort of party cohesion, making sure that any member of the party has something that the rest of the party members want. Even if it's just, hey, we have a common goal. We're headed to the same place. Want to travel together? You can do that. You can make it so they have information about the main quest line that the rest of the party needs. You know, kind of feeding them a little bit of info is a very solid way to make sure that the rest of the party wants them around. But yeah, like Dev said, you also don't have to overcomplicate it that much, because above the table, we all know that you want this party member to join. And we all know, like, you know, you're not going to in-game reject this person and just like send them home, you know? So for, to some degree, you don't have to stress about it as much as you would think. If you think about, again, I'm going to use Critical Role as an example because I don't watch that many AKs outside of that. When they had Tarion, I think his name is, step in and Scanlan step out, literally his only like reason for staying with the party was, hey, I'll hire you guys to kind of teach me how to be an adventurer sort of thing. I may be getting that wrong. It's been a while, but like kind of, it was very hand wave from that on. Like, obviously, if it was an NPC, the party wouldn't have said yes. But above the table, everyone knew, yeah, this is a new character. We got to bring him into the party. So we'll do a little throwaway sentence to introduce them and then call it good. So I would look up tips for making sure that party cohesion is a thing. But also, like, again, that's not really your job as a DM as much as it is the parties from that point onward.
I want to say that a little bonus that you can kind of tug at for weaving them in as potentially an NPC or a contact of an NPC or otherwise important to your plot is, if this is a person who's joining your campaign, and I'm just saying this to cover some bases here, if this is a person that's joining your campaign who's just like interested in trying to play a tabletop game and they don't know the first thing about making a character, that's honestly like the best situation, because you can deliver a character to them to play. You can say, hey, I will either sit with you and make this character together, or I've already got this like important plot relevant character. I'm perfectly happy to hand their autonomy over to you and you take them from here. That I've done that in the past. It works great. If they end up getting killed, then they can make their first real actual character. And they can use what they have learned from playing this one character to make one of their own. It's a great way to ease somebody in, especially for temporary. If there's a person who's like, I can only show up for a couple of sessions here and there, or maybe it's somebody who's in town for the week and you've got a game scheduled and they're just happen to be there and you want to include them, you can just give them an NPC to play for a little while.
Excellent question, Abby. Thank you so much for submitting.
Thank you.
All right, we got another one in here from someone who goes by Former Future Frog, who uses Zer pronouns. The question is, I am designing a world with gods who don't have a good or evil alignment. I want to have an overarching evil church person who is twisting the words of a god to their will, and was wondering if y'all have any tips with that. Generally, how do you do neutral gods and people who are trying to make them not neutral?
Yeah, so for one, I actually find, and maybe this is just me, but I actually find that the majority of the gods that I am building are neutral. Like morality is sort of a concept that in my head is a mortal concept, whereas gods are just facts of existence, and morals are, whether or not they are evil or good or whatever, is like placed upon them by those who are interpreting their words. And so from that perspective, the majority of the gods, I mean, they could be argued as neutral. So that's like one sort of drop. But there are plenty of concepts that can have gods associated with them that are really, I don't want to say mundane, but aren't necessarily good or evil. One could make the argument that the god of war is probably evil-ish or a bit aggro, but like the god of life and fertility is probably like a good aligned god. But then you've got like the god of the harvest, which, like, you know, there's arguments to be made that like, oh, that feeds people or whatever, but does it? Does this harvest god need to be good, or are they just like, yeah, I grow plants. I don't care what people do with them. I just make plants grow. I don't care about literally any downstream effects. Nature's rad. That's what I do. But you could take that and you could run with either having a person interpret them as the ultimate force of good. They are the one that feeds us, and therefore we must like sacrifice to them to have good harvests. And those sacrifices get increasingly dangerous. Or they can say, we want to leverage this god to prevent the harvest. Maybe it's some sort of BBEG, you had an overarching evil church person who is trying to interpret the words of this god, and they're getting frustrated because the god isn't giving them one thing or another, because the god doesn't care about their concept of morality, and they just kind of lose it and just start making up something just to speak for the god, because otherwise they can't make heads or tails of what this god's trying to do, which is a very fair thing. Mortals are not supposed to be able to comprehend the wills of gods. That's what separates gods from mortals. So ultimately, like, you can really make any, you can pick any topic, give it a god, and you can make an argument one way or another. There's some stuff, like I said, that can be more inherently good or evil, but there's plenty more neutral subjects that if you wanted to, you could veer them in one way or the other. I would start with something along the lines of harvest or travel or the day-night cycle. Like, just things that are just like facts. Things are just exist that don't necessarily have moral implications.
It depends on how you deal with power when it comes to your deities in your world, but, and we spoke about this in one of the very first episodes of the Atlas Room, actually, where we talked about gods and how they get their power and how they bestow power amongst their followers. But if you make it so that that evil church person that you're planning is slowly siphoning power from the god through the rituals and things like that. So, for instance, they slightly change the wording of the prayers to state that that evil church person is like a middleman. And then they slowly start writing themselves in to become more and more important over time. It's like writing a procedure for a company and making yourself an integral part of the procedure so that way no one can fire you. I've done that. If you make it so that your deity's power is sourced from the amount of people that follow them and by those amounts of prayers and things like that and the types of rituals that are being done, all of a sudden that power is being diverted to this evil church person and they are getting more and more powerful. And it's happening over such a slow period of time that the rest of the following doesn't quite comprehend that that shift is even happening. That is a really good setup, and also a really good setup for a potential player character. You know, someone who realizes what's happening and breaks away from the religion and then decides, this isn't what I signed up for. This isn't the worship that I know. This isn't the god that I know. And then they go off and they have an adventure and they kind of go back and try and confront that part of their past. I think it's a really good plot hook, a really good character arc.
I love that. One more thing I would sprinkle on top would be a truly neutral god. And you know, there's various interpretations of neutral. But you can imagine a god that is truly not worried about what mortals think or what mortals are doing. This god is existing and just doing their own thing. They're not good or evil, and so they're not fighting back against the opposite alignment. You know, you've got your good gods that are trying to stop evil gods from doing evil things and vice versa. But the neutral gods are just catching a chill-ass vibe. And it can be frustrating for someone who worships this god to basically just never hear anything, never see any real proof of miracles, never really, like, have anything pan out. They could have dedicated their entire life to this god, but this god truly does not care and is just existing and is just maintaining whatever they are or is in their purview. And that frustration can fuel any number of outbursts, be it an evil outburst where they're, as Diana said, like, sort of writing themselves in to fulfill the position of speaking for this god because this god's not speaking for themselves. Or it could be that they decide that they've been scorned by this god and now they're mad and they want to kill a god, because who doesn't want to kill a god at some point, you know? Neutrality doesn't necessarily mean that it has no positive or negative impact. Neutrality just means not trying to accomplish a specific direction. It's not concerned with the rest of the goings-ons, which is in itself extraordinarily frustrating for anyone who's not neutral.
All right. Thank you so much, former Future Frog. Amazing name. And once again, if you guys have anything that you want us to answer, any sort of questions about running games, world building, storytelling, be sure to send them in to wish@theatlasloom.com. We love hearing them.
Diana.
Yeah.
I have a wish. I wish for you to tell me.
Oh, boy.
Where people will be able to find you and I very soon.
Oh, man. Like, physically.
Yes.
Yeah. Holy shit. So, fun thing, we're going to be in Boston at the end of this next month. That's this month because it's coming out next week.
We're recording this on the leap day of February.
Yeah.
So it's really difficult when we're talking about timing right now, y'all. Just bear with us, okay?
So March 21st through 24th is PAX East, which is over in Boston. Dev and I are both going as media people, fancy content creator type folks. And we will be there wandering around, and we're both pretty distinct. You've got the beanie, I've got the hair. If you see us, come say hello. We do genuinely like saying hi to you guys. Like, please don't be afraid. And I want to hear everything you have to say about the Atlas Loom, good or bad. Mostly good, though. I am quite sensitive.
Absolutely. If you see us, come say hi. It was an absolute blast to meet folks at PAX Unplugged. We're going to be at PAX
so
East.
Fun.
We're going to be at Gen Con later on. Well, it's just one thing at a time. One con at a time.
I will also say, very similar to what we did for PAX Unplugged, for all you bonus world weavers out there, we will be putting out an episode that is exclusive to y'all. All you gilded folk, you gilded world weavers out there, we will be sitting down after PAX East and just chatting over how it went, all the cool people we met, all the fun things that we saw. I'm going to brag about my business card some more. And so if you aren't a Gilded World Weaver, head over to theatlasloom.com today. And for $5 a month or $50 a year, you can get access to that, as well as every bonus episode we've put out so far and any ones into the future. So highly recommend it. They are fucking hilarious.
I think so, too. More things you can do, though, beyond just if you want to.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this part.
Yeah, yeah, this part.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Hey, y'all. Atlas Loom merch is a thing now. So I just launched a merch store, shop.endeavorance.camp, and it includes a handful of wonderful Atlas Loom items. You can grab yourself an Atlas Loom tee, a mug. We've got a desk mat. We've got a knit sweater. Don't worry about that. We got all sorts of stuff. There's even a journal up there with the Atlas Loom logo on it that you can write down all of your favorite world building ideas into. There's going to be more over time, so check back often. We'll link to it in the show notes here. I'll link directly to the Atlas Loom collection. It is lovely. We have, I would say, a very good logo, and we're going to put it on everything we can think of.
I want one of those fucking blankets, dude.
The blanket.
Oh my God.
Y'all.
Got my eye on it.
There's an Atlas Loom throw blanket. And I shit you not, I ordered it as a sample. I have used it every day since I've ordered it. I sit on my couch, I throw it over my lap, I plop my laptop on top, and I do some world building with my Atlas Loom blankie. It is wonderful. It's so cozy. It's so soft. I love it. With all of that said, I think we've covered it. We've gotten to the end of the episode now. We can do the whole being done with the episode thing here. My name is Endeavorance. You can find everything I do at endeavorance.camp. Of course, you can head to shop.endeavorance.camp for all sorts of fun stuff. And again, Atlas Loom merch. I am joined, as always, by the absolutely incredible Diana Fey. Tell us about you.
That's me. I'm Diana Fey. I am a TTRPG content creator, actual play performer, podcast co-host, as you've seen for the past hour or however long this episode ends up being. And I am mostly found over on TikTok and Twitch, but really on all platforms. I am at Diana of the Rose. That's all we got for you guys today. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Atlas Loom. Our paths will cross again soon, but in the meantime, keep on weaving your worlds.